He's doing good, yeah.
Click chapter 7, sampling strategies. What I've done, and I'll send this out, I had a question. When you're the person who leads the discussion, you were supposed to type it up, a summary. No?
Nobody else has.
Okay, for some reason I...
no, this is where you're off the hook.
Oh, okay, so yeah. I don't have to submit something?
No, nothing. No, you just, yeah.
Okay, well, what I have then is two pages of just point form, breaking down section by section.
I didn't lose a little screw, but I probably did. It's still in there. Oh, good. Okay. Never mind. Sorry. It's just popped right out. I don't know why, for no reasons at all. Go ahead. I'm so sorry.
No problem. I'm just going to glaze over the main topics then. There's too much. If you flip to page 62, table 7.1, or make note of it, this offers a very nice overview of the decision processes that need to be made when thinking about sampling in the research process. Here, while collecting data, there's two things you need to do: is determine what the case sampling, who to interview, and sample groups of cases, which groups the case sample should come from. While interpreting data, material sampling, which data should be further treated, here meaning transcribed and analyzed, because as I discovered, it's not necessary to transcribe everything or to analyze everything, because a lot of it, or some of it, can be deemed irrelevant. And as well, sampling within the material, what parts of the data should be interpreted in general and which part in particular. And while presenting the findings, the presentational sampling, which cases and data are best to demonstrate the findings. I'm hoping there's going to be more on this in a later chapter.
Okay. On which part exactly?
Presentational sampling. When you're trying to make your point or indicate your findings in a final paper, how do you choose what is relevant, what isn't?
Yeah, I'm not sure it does, although the analysis kind of... It depends on your analysis and your question, doesn't it? I don't think that it's going to be able to, I don't think Flip goes in any more detail than that, because then it becomes so specific to what you're doing. But we will think about that even tonight when we're looking at Ed's story.
But doesn't, in a different part of the chapter and in a different context, doesn't Flick reference Patton, and there's the different where you can have the divergent cases, or you can have an analogy and different things. Can you not do that when you're presenting as well? Can you not pick a representative element within it? So if you're looking at transcripts and you've got, say, five different sections where it's got some sort of unit of meaning, can you not choose from among those same sort of sets of whether or not you're showing a range, or whether you're showing completely divergent ones, or you're showing similar ones? Depending on whether, because there can only be a certain number of choices that you can make. And I would imagine it's the same ones. That's what I was starting to look at. But it would be the same ones for choosing what to focus on as to what to present. Does that make sense? I don't have Flick's book in front of me, so that's at home.
He's taking this.
But you know, doesn't he have the whole list of patents things and then like whole bunch of points?
Oh, I have them listed later.
Right.
Yeah.
But does it not make sense that you could use that for presentation as well?
For making your decisions. You mean.
Yes, yeah. Using it as your system or.
I hadn't thought of that, but I'll move on. Thank you. Let's see, where am I? Oh, the different types of sample structures. There's the a priori determination, and essentially just the meaning of it. Well, hold on. Yes, the definition for this is that this is the type of structure predetermined based upon an abstract of some sort, an abstract criteria, where these criteria are all independent of the collected data, which means, in the famous words of my supervisor, what does the literature tell you the criteria should be?
Which is endlessly helpful.
Yes. There's also, within the a priori determination, the notion of the complete collection, and here would be a complete analysis of all available records, pardon me, as well as the representational collection, and here it's limited by filling all sample structures fields, and here, if you go to page 6263, table 7.2, what has to be remembered in regard to a priori determination is this sampling method is not necessarily the best for any type of theory development, but is great for hypothesis testing.
So would this be something like what's called stratified sampling?
Quantitative realm.
What is stratified?
Or criterion sampling. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's if you have a population that has a certain number of distinct classes, what you do is before taking the sample, you decide on how many people or how many subjects would you choose from each specific class. And that's how you design the
Speaking
sample.
Speaking of, say, a high school, what would the class, what would classes? You mean teachers, administration,
could that,
students?
Those could be three classes.
Are there others possible?
Yep. Those could be three possible classes.
That's why it's sometimes called criterion-based sampling as well. You've got a set of criteria on which you're going to fill. Much so like, well, like the table showing, isn't it? Wouldn't that be a type two?
Criterion reference and stratified sampling.
I think sometimes isn't like if there's a, if a certain group makes up 10% of the population, then you make sure that 10% of your sample is like it matches kind of.
And sometimes for some research you actually want to oversample a particular part of the population. It might make up just 10%, but you want like 25 or 30% of your sample to be that. So you do that. Stratified sampling. But anyway, this table reminded me of that.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I forgot to mention, there seem to be three different types of sampling selections that can be used. The first, of course, being a priori. The second being theoretical sampling. And this is premised upon the idea of the emerging theory or gradual definition as you go through the... as you go through the different... analyses. So you look at an initial analysis, and that would inform what the next data collection would look like and what you would be looking at there. A question popped into my head, and I was hoping if Fiona could answer this, because I know she knows more about this than me. Isn't this design theory, or an example of design theory? Can you help with that again? Notion that in theoretical sampling, a gradual definition or a theory will emerge. So you look at the initial data, and let's say you go out and do 50 interviews and you look at that and then you determine, well, these are some criteria that are emerging. This seems to be a general theme or a theory. I'm going to do a second run asking a different question and I'm going to explore that theory to see if it keeps emerging. Isn't that a type of design theory?
What are you designing?
Good point.
It's similar in the iterative nature, but this just came to me like not too long ago when I was actually writing my report for the last class, is what design really is. Isn't it? It's a problem that you're designing something to address. And if there's not a problem and something that's being designed to address that problem, it's not a design experiment. That's what I've come up with.
Right, which is good because it gives us a really clear separation between grounded theory, which
that sounds like grounded theory. Which you can do in a design, but there also has to be the design.
And the problem.
Okay. Moving past that question. The theory development from the empirical data is the point of reference for all criteria for choosing a next case to collect data from. We would stop integrating new cases when theoretical saturation, page 6465, if you want to look this up, takes place.
That's what I had said at one point in the class. Do you remember when I said how you know when you've analyzed enough or when you've sampled enough in this case and you've analyzed enough is when you start getting the same things? Saturation.
That's a great word, saturation. It sums it up.
The third selection, the sampling selection, is gradual selection. And here there are a few different perspectives. One being data trial. Pardon me. Sorry. I'm going to make it use my voice today. First being data triangulation, which is the integrating of differing data sources, or institutions in this case, studying the same phenomenon at different times and places and with different persons. Again, I had a question here. This idea seems to be slightly problematic, for is not a phenomenon dependent upon its context and environment. And if you're looking at phenomena in different times and places with different people, how can any of the context or environments be comparable, and therefore the data comparable?
Your question is, how can they be similar to the context?
I understood a phenomena when they were going to study or do analysis of as being dependent upon the context in which it mm-hmm. is derived and the environment in which it is derived. Mm-hmm. So if data triangulation is attempting to look at different data sources but looking at the same phenomena in these different data sources at different times and places with different persons, aren't you changing far too many of the
time? Well, it reminds me of I can't even remember who did the painting, maybe even got that painting with the haystack in the morning, in the afternoon, at night. It's the same phenomenon, but it's taken from different perspective. I don't know who painted that. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
That's
what it reminds me of anyway.
If you're working from postmodern approaches, where your aim is to look at the function of the discourse, then that would be an irrelevant issue, and triangulation would not appear in that kind of epistemology. Of course, it's obvious it appears if you're describing a thing that you believe is based in reality. Like if you believe your research is at that level of I am describing, like ethnography would be a case where they go in and describe what's going on in a particular school or classroom, which would be ethnographic type 1 research, where you would supposedly have the highest level of triangulation possible. Okay, so because you'd be saying, well, I can verify that this did happen, and you'd be interested in getting at accuracy of your description. And then there'd be the middle level, which is the more phenomenological and looking at subjective experience, where some would argue triangulation to a certain extent is possible, depending on your research question. So if that level is looking at the thing as perceived by the individual, so your triangulation might be the thing as perceived by numerous different individuals. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not attempting to show accuracy in triangulation, but rather different interpretations on the same phenomenon. You got me going. So your epistemology, again, dictates a great deal about whether or not this becomes appropriate.
Okay. And then the last part of the biocritical reflection or of sampling is the notion of analytic induction here, if you flip to page 67. Here it's concerned with its developing theory and comparing deviant cases to control and better define this theory, essentially what theory is not. There's a quote on 67, theoretical sampling wants to control the process of selecting data by the emerging theory. Analytic induction uses the deviant case to control the developing theory. If you look to box 7.2 on page 69, there's a list of all of the different sampling strategies in qualitative research. I'm not going to mention any of them, except the last two, which are primary and secondary selections. I thought this was worthy of of a short explanation. In primary selection, participants, and a quote again, should have the capacity to reflect and articulate, should have the time to be asked or observed, and should be ready to participate. Those are the criteria in order to have something, what is called primary selection. Secondary selection is if your individual does not meet all the criteria of primary selection, which I think is fairly straightforward. But you mentioned it was interesting.
I found it interesting, yeah, that there was even such a thing as a secondary level, because it's sort of like, well, what are you going to get out of the secondary people if they're willing to participate? It's like, but if you don't know about this phenomenon, I just found it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Background information. But again, I've never had to use this level of thinking about sampling, so it would depend on your question. I could see it being more pertinent maybe when you're making arguments for why later, when you're looking at your data, why you're not taking the testimony of certain individuals on board in your analysis, you might argue that they're giving you secondary kind of accounts, and therefore, because they're not meeting the full criteria of understanding the phenomenon. That's only one possibility I could think of.
But a bit more in regards to quasi-qualitative, quantitative.
That's a good idea.
Where, let's say you use secondary selection to determine your criteria, as well as the demographics of the population in which you are going to then go back for a second round of interviews or second round of data collection, and those then become the primary selectors, in that you've got the demographic information, you have a sense, or you've been able to develop a partial theory up to this point, and you're going to extrapolate on that with the primary selection.
Yeah.
That's how I looked at it.
Sort of an exploratory thing where you kind of have your... You don't want to narrow it down too tightly, is that what you're saying, before you've got a...
Well, you use secondary selection, because at this point you don't know what all the criteria are.
Right.
And so, and I was thinking of Marty, actually, when I was contemplating this, where you have all these variables that you think are important. So a survey or a questionnaire or something like that to a large swath of the potential population. And you ask them then to rank or whatever, how important are these variables to your decision making? If we were thinking of like the notion of being an entrepreneur, you then have a scope, and then you're able to determine, well, these are seem to be the most important. And again, because of that, not all of your secondary selectors will have said these were important to them, but you're able to determine just statistically that these seem to be important to the vast majority, and that then becomes a criteria for your primary selector.
So it's interesting, because in both the example I gave and the example you gave, they're ad hoc uses of that, and yet that goes, it's, sampling should be a priori decision making, shouldn't it, to some extent? So I guess maybe that's true, that a lot of sampling and qualitative gets thought about not just at the beginning, at the outset of the research, which it would always get thought of in quantitative, but is something that's an ongoing process. You have sampling, thinking, and decision making going on in the beginning, in the middle, when you start saying, oh, I better go get some more people on this, you know, and at the end, when you later then look back.
And that's just the nature of the exploratory.
Again, yeah.
Nature of the research that you let it be messy at first and then drill down deeper once you think you've identified issues until you get saturation.
And again, think about it. I'm always thinking like this for myself, and maybe for you too, to some extent. If your research looked messy in terms of its sampling, and you have to give your justification for that, this provides, you know, Flick has given us a kind of structure to put into the mess to say, look, you know, it makes sense theoretically when you think about it that you've got to make sampling decisions all the way through the process, as opposed to just at the beginning.
Final two sections. One is in regard to depth and width. Quote page 70, I think it's easiest to say this. Sampling decisions always fluctuate between the aims of covering as wide a field as possible and doing analyses which are as deep as possible. And I think this comes through as you're doing your interpretation, analysis and interpretation, that there might be some variables, I don't want to call them variables, but certain themes that need more attention, and at which point you would turn away from trying to explain the entire phenomenon and just looking at a particular theme within that phenomenon, and vice versa, you may find that there aren't enough themes, so you may want to try to explore the entire phenomenon. And finally, and I thought this was the most really interesting, the entire chapter was looking at the notion of a case and samples of cases without ever getting around to defining what the case represents in the entire process. And there seem to be five interlinked steps that build upon each other. One, it's an individualized universal. To an individual, this is what this phenomenon is, or they perceive it to be. It's specific institutional context in which the individual acts. So again, it provides the context for the individual and therefore the universal. Specific, codified, and encultured perspective. Here it's a profession. Develop subjectivity thanks to the attainment of the particular profession, so the way professionals think. Shown, talk about that more. And interactively made and makeable context of activity. So it seems as though we start with, if we start at the bottom in regard to being able to make, it's made or makeable through a group of professionals in regard to context of activities, that then leads to a particular way of thinking for those professionals, which then is codified and cultured in the profession, and that then creates institutional context in which all these individuals have to act, and therefore it becomes an individualized universal for the entire group, the entire professional group, as well as every single individual within it. And I am done.
Good job.
I'm going to go find water.
Clear as mud now? Okay. Thanks, Steve. Okay, so before we move into our last two readings, I'm just going to give a little mini introduction to this whole area now, narrative.